So as you can see, our atmospheric carbon dioxide levels currently sit at 416 parts per million. This is far in excess of any historical record during the last three glacial cycles, which is just shown there on the second graph, pretty phenomenally higher. In fact, the last time the atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide were this high was in the Pliocene era, between 2.6 and 5.3 million years ago, when sea levels were 20 metres above where they are now. Then there's methane emissions. So methane emissions have a global warming potential of about 84 times as much as carbon dioxide in the first 20 years of being in the atmosphere. And as the graph shows here, methane emissions have risen by 10% over the last two decades, and atmospheric levels are currently sitting at 2.5 times greater than pre-industrial levels. But despite the world hurtling towards climate catastrophe, no country is doing anywhere near enough to deal with this problem. So the IPCC has been measuring the gap between the amounts of emissions we should be releasing to keep under 1.5 and the amounts of emissions that are actually being released. And it's showing that the gap is continuing to grow, not shrinking. So the blue line up the top there is where we're currently heading, and the green line down the bottom is where we're supposed to be. And the effects of global warming are already being felt around the world. This was really brought home to us here in Australia just last year when 19 million hectares of forest were burnt and 3,000 homes were destroyed in the Black Summer fires. And just like last month, the whole of the East Coast was basically paralysed by flooding. So it's a big problem when the environment movement continues to insist that the climate crisis can be solved within the frameworks of capitalism, a system that's driven by short-term profit and competition. Even the authors of the IPCC report that I mentioned before say that to keep warming to just 1.5 degrees, it would require rapid, far-reaching and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society starting immediately. And that's something no country anywhere in the world seems willing to do. In this talk, I'm going to go through the main things people say to support the idea that it is possible to turn things around without breaking with the current system. I'll start by critiquing the claim that the market can solve the climate crisis, and then I'll look at the idea that we can rely on state intervention and regulation to do it. I'll address some specific strategies that people put forward here, like the Green New Deal, and I'll end with a brief argument that only a working-class revolution to smash capitalism and implement socialism can begin to deal with the myriad environmental crises we're facing today. So firstly, I want to start with the most right-wing argument, and that's that the market and individual capitalists are going to deal with the crisis for us. So proponents point to the falling price of renewables to back this up. Last year, Francisco Lacamara, the Director General of the International Renewables Energy Agency, said, "We have reached an important turning point in the energy transition. The case for new and much of the existing coal power generation is both environmentally and economically unjustifiable. Renewable energy is increasingly the cheapest source of new electricity, offering tremendous potential to stimulate the global economy and get people back to work. Renewable investments are stable, cost-effective and attractive, offering constant and predictable returns while delivering benefits to the wider economy." Proponents also point to the growing number of companies who either extract or heavily use fossil fuels, pledging net zero emissions by 2050 as evidence that there's a trend away from investment in coal and gas and oil. So some big names on this list also include BP, Shell, GM, Ford, Volkswagen, and at least a dozen airlines have made these sorts of pledges. Right, so how do these arguments hold up against the data? Well, let's have a look at the figures. So it's true that the cost of renewable energy has decreased dramatically in the past decade. On average, new solar voltaic and onshore wind power cost less than keeping many of the existing coal plants in operation. Investment in renewables has also increased rapidly. The total investment in renewable energy was $282.2 billion last year, which far outstripped investment in coal-fired power generation, which was at $37 billion, and gas at $47 billion. Investment in renewables is set to grow by a further $3.4 trillion over the next decade in 38%, and 38% of global electricity could be generated by solar and wind by 2030. But just looking at electricity generation alone doesn't give you the whole story. The $282 billion of investment in renewable energy in 2019 has to be seen in the context of the $1.8 trillion of global investment in the energy industry as a whole. This includes $505 billion worth of investment in the oil and gas supply, not to mention the trillions of dollars of historic investment in fossil fuel reserves that companies will want to squeeze out every last cent of. Right. So there will have to be a massive reduction in fossil fuel consumption if we're going to get anywhere near the 7.6% emissions reduction every year that the IPCC says we should. But projections by the International Energy Agency show that with renewables on the rise, fossil fuels will still meet an overwhelming majority of demand in 2040. In fact, as this graph shows, even if all countries take their climate policy commitments seriously, it still won't be enough to curb demand for fossil fuels and the emissions that will result from it. Only a serious overhaul of the economy to run it sustainably can reverse that trend. So to put what this would look like in a bit of perspective, during the COVID crisis last year, there was a substantial drop in emissions when lockdowns caused the aviation industry to grind to a halt, road travel reduced significantly, and the global economy contracted by 4.3%. Even with all this disruption, though, emissions only shrank by 6.4%, which is still well short of the 7.6% we need, and they're already starting to shoot upwards as economies grind back into gear. So obviously I'm not arguing that we need to have COVID as like a model for emissions reduction, but it does kind of give you the idea of the sort of drastic changes that would be needed if we're going to halt global warming. It's also misleading to focus solely on emissions reductions. The list of environmental crises we face today is quite long. For example, plastic is one of the most widely used industrial materials in the world, and it's also a global environmental disaster. So there are huge islands of plastic floating around the ocean. One is called the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, and it sits between California and Japan. It's twice the size of Texas, and it's getting bigger and bigger every year. A 2017 study from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation found that by 2050, the Earth's oceans will contain more plastic than fish. Plastic doesn't easily biodegrade either. It just breaks down into smaller and smaller pieces, making its way into our water supplies, food, and even into the air we breathe. It's been estimated that humans ingest a credit card's worth of plastic every week, and scientists don't really know what the long-term impacts of this will be on our health. But despite the environmental and health risks of plastic, the World Economic Forum estimates that production will triple by 2050. This is a problem that will have to be addressed at a global scale. But the point is that investment in green energy is just a tiny blip on the scale of what needs to be done to reorganise society along sustainable lines. Another thing is that all those corporate pledges I mentioned earlier for net zero emissions are basically bullshit. Shell's plan alone would require tree planting over an area nearly the size of Brazil, and they're cutting down a lot of the trees in Brazil at the moment anyway. So according to estimates by an NGO, ActionAid, there's simply not enough land on the planet to accommodate all of the combined corporate and government net zero plans for offsets and carbon sinking tree plantations. Also, most plans for getting to net zero also they rely on development of carbon capture and storage technologies. But the idea that this is going to be scaled up to the level that would be required to make a serious dent in global emissions is completely fanciful. After decades of fossil fuel supporters spruiking carbon capture, there's only really 20 functioning examples of this around the world. So there's no technological silver bullet that is going to fix the climate crisis. We're going to need a thoroughgoing system change to do that. And all the pledges of zero emissions really amounts to is corporate and government greenwashing, I think. And contrary to what many say about the climate in the climate movement about the crisis, we're not actually all in this together. Another reason we can't rely on the fossil fuel bosses and the capitalist class in general to solve the crisis for us is because they won't suffer the consequences of their actions like the rest of us will. Unlike poor populations in low-lying coastal areas threatened by rising sea levels, the capitalist class can just simply buy themselves out of the most extreme effects of climate change. A recent Forbes article reported the latest trend among the world's billionaires, which is buying outrageous underground bunkers with luxury amenities, as you can see here, everything you need in the apocalypse, including swimming pools, bowling alleys, and gun ranges. So this is where the fossil fuel bosses plan to live out the climate crisis while the rest of us burn or drown or die of starvation or thirst. We live in a class-divided society where a small number of very rich and powerful people have very different interests and motivations than the rest of humanity. To them, nature is like a free gift. The raw materials provide them with resources to generate massive amounts of profit. And any side effects like pollution of waterways and oceans, air and soil contamination, or global warming are what those in the industry euphemistically like to call externalized cost. Capitalism is also a system built on competition, and that's why companies are always against any penalties or pollution or unsustainable practices because this would affect their competitive edge. So given all the evidence I've just outlined, I think it's pretty clear that we can't rely on the market and the capitalist class itself to deal with the environmental crisis. One of the other main arguments for not breaking with capitalism is that we can just rely on the state and state intervention and regulation of industry to create a more sustainable economy and mitigate the effects of climate change. But if the current efforts of government around the world are anything to go by, this argument is beginning to sound more and more far-fetched. The 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, which was the most significant global agreement to date, stipulates that countries need to set target emissions targets to keep global warming below 2 degrees and strive for 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. It also aims to hit net zero emissions by mid-century. But governments set their own targets and there are no enforcement mechanisms to hold them to account. Most experts now say that government pledges are not ambitious enough to limit warming to 2 degrees. Instead, even if every country met their targets, we will be looking at global warming somewhere in the vicinity of 3 degrees. And this assumes that every country will meet its targets. Germany, a country considered at the cutting edge of emissions reductions, which is a point I'll come back to later on, barely met its 2020 target. And actually, a report by a German think tank, Agora Energiewende, found that 60% of the drop in emissions that got that country over the line in the end was due to the effects of the COVID-19 crisis. So last year I read heaps of opinion pieces that said that, in like the liberal press, that said that the COVID-19 crisis presented this grand opportunity for governments to reorganise the world along sustainable and socially just lines. But the response has really just been the opposite. Everywhere we've seen governments throw the planet and hundreds of thousands of workers just under the bus, all in the name of saving their economies. Here in Australia, instead of moving away from fossil fuels, the government has used the crisis as an excuse to expand the natural gas industry. According to a 2019 report by Climate Analytics, Australian gas exports contribute to 0.6% of total global emissions from burning fossil fuels. According to the Global Energy Monitor, Australia has $56 billion worth of gas pipelines in development that, if completed, would contribute to as much emissions as 33 new coal-fired power stations. Again, this is just looking at emissions. Deforestation is yet another global environmental disaster. And this is rapidly accelerating. Over the past 2 years, Brazilian far-right President Jair Bolsonaro has been overseeing the ongoing destruction of the Amazon, the largest rainforest in the world. The Amazon is home to 10% of the world's plants and animal species and is a vital carbon sink. In 2019, deforestation in the Amazon reached its highest level in a decade. According to Brazil's National Space Research Institute, in the year from August 2018 to July 2019, almost a million hectares of forest were destroyed, up to 30% from the previous year. It's a real shame. These fires were mostly lit by loggers, miners and farmers eager to expand their operations despite the impact it would have on biodiversity, Indigenous communities and the climate. Curbing deforestation would get in the way of the ability of these sectors to make profit, something Bolsonaro wholeheartedly supports. But perhaps I'm being a bit unfair. I mean, Australia and Brazil, after all, do have pretty right-wing governments, so it's to be expected that they would act in accordance with the interests of business and not with the health of the planet. But what about the Biden administration's climate plan? Many are hopeful that the Democrat president will be able to lead the way in getting us out of the crisis. For example, Adam Bandt, the leader of the Australian Greens, was all praise for the new president, tweeting, "With Biden naming climate change an existential threat and a plan for net zero emissions electricity, pressure is now on Australia." After 4 years of Trump, Biden's sweeping executive orders on the environment have come as a relief to many. He promised to listen to the science, rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement, and committed to net zero emissions by 2050. So this included a range of policies, such as putting a pause on all new permits for and leases for drilling oil and gas offshore and on federal land, electrifying the federal fleet, and shutting down the Keystone XL pipeline that environmental activists have been protesting for years. And at face value, all this does seem like a break with the fossil fuel-hungry way the US economy has been run in the past. But look a little closer and you'll find that Biden's climate policy leaves a lot to be desired. A pause on drilling is not a ban, and the administration has quietly approved tens of new drilling operations anyway. There's no mention of fracking, which is a very lucrative sector in the US and is incredibly environmentally destructive. None of the measures come even close to the 7.6% drop in emissions I mentioned earlier, and there are no plans for emissions reductions in the first 4 years of his presidency at all. Investment in renewables can coexist alongside fossil fuel production under capitalism as another avenue for making profits. Biden is aware of this, which is why most of his plan is about a huge injection of money to build infrastructure projects. This is in line with the needs of US capitalism, which has needed state stimulus spending to recover from the impact of the COVID-19 crisis. It'll do next to nothing to achieve the necessary emissions reductions to keep global temperatures below 1.5 degrees, and it just serves to greenwash his very pro-capitalist, pro-fossil fuel administration. Okay, so what about the Green New Deal then? This is supposedly the most radical version of how state intervention can be used to solve these crises without needing to break with capitalism. The Green New Deal has been popularised recently by people like Ocasio-Cortez on the screen there and Bernie Sanders as a really radical strategy for running capitalism in a more sustainable and socially just way. Proponents of that strategy claim that state intervention and regulation with those things, we can have a sustainable society that meets the needs of the population and also looks after the planet while simultaneously allowing for economic growth. Green New Deals, though, are now being adopted by politicians across the political spectrum, including Malcolm Turnbull, who in an opinion piece in The Guardian last year argued that the government should adopt a Green New Deal, which I think by that he just meant his National Energy Guarantee, which is not really a radical program for reorganising the economy in an environmentally and socially just way. So the fact that the Green New Deal label is being used by basically any politician or government who wants to greenwash their policies gives you a sense of how little most of these deals will actually do to save the environment. But yeah, setting aside those clearly quite bullshit versions of the Green New Deal, let's have a look at some of the more radical versions like those by Ocasio-Cortez, because I still think that they're utopian. And to prove it, I just want to take a moment to look at an example of a Green New Deal and how it played out in practice. Okay, so in 2008, under the Lee Myung-bak administration, Korea adopted green growth as its new development vision. In a country which had a massive emissions problem, this Green New Deal would create an estimated 960,000 new jobs and would create a number of green measures, include a number of green measures, including investment in renewable energies and a tree planting program. Although the groundwork was set before his presidency began, Lee oversaw the construction of a new city called New Songdo City. And this was supposed to be like a new green sustainable development. So the Korean Green New Deal was lauded internationally as the cutting edge of state-driven green growth. In 2010, Lee was awarded the Syed International Prize for the Environment, the most prestigious international environment award, for his vision and leadership in pursuing green growth and in transforming his economy into a low-carbon, resource-efficient and green economy. Korea also established the Global Green Growth Institute, which was given UN blessing in 2012 as an international organisation to develop green initiatives. So was Korea's Green New Deal all that it was cut out to be? When you examine the detail, it's very underwhelming. To name a few examples, despite the talk of renewables in the plan, the largest share of the budget for non-hydrocarbon sources was going to be nuclear. And at the time, Korea already had the highest density of nuclear reactors in the world and came fifth for capacity. Then there's the new Songdo city itself, just shown there on the left, or your right. it sounds like a green paradise, but the environmental impact of building a whole new city from scratch really far outweighs the benefits of a few smart, sustainable features. And it also meant draining the Songdo tidal flat, which was an important way station for migratory birds. It was also designed to be an aerotropolis, which is a fancy way of saying a city built around aviation, which is hardly an area of sustainability. The Four Rivers Restoration Project, which was part of the Green New Deal, would account for about 37% of the budget and was actually a revamped version of one of Lee's previous environmentally disastrous plans, which helped earn him the title of Bulldozer before he became the green god of the world. The project basically planned to carve out a colossal canal system, which centred on a 541-kilometre super canal that would enable cargo freighters to steam through flooded mountain tunnels from Seoul across to Busan. This represented a massive intervention into South Korea's river systems with devastating environmental effects and had been widely opposed by voters. But now Lee had dressed it up in green growth rhetoric, and suddenly it became this like acceptable green project. So when the layers of green window dressing are peeled back from Korea's Green New Deal, its core is revealed to be a nuclear energy expansion, land reclamation, canal cutting and dredging, and construction of a multitude of dams and weirs, all of which would place further stress on the country's embattled ecosystems. Okay. So another example of what proponents of the Green New Deal strategy point to is Germany's just transition away from coal mining. So in 2018, Germany closed its black coal industry and plans to phase out coal completely by 2038. And this is being done supposedly without sacking a single worker. Many in the environment movement hold this example up as a potential model for a green economy. But the problem is when you look behind the rosy headlines, things are not as fantastic as they're made out to be. Even though Germany has stopped black coal mining, they haven't stopped using it. So 12% of the country's electricity is generated from black coal, and even when this is phased out, black coal imports will still continue to fuel the steel industry, which is the fifth largest in the world. And it's still one of the largest consumers of brown coal in the world. The foreign sources of Germany's black coal really put the question of the so-called just transitions into the spotlight. Coal is sourced from places like the Cerrejón mine in Colombia, which is notorious for killing union activists when they try to unionise the mines, and Indigenous activists when they protest the dispossession of their land. So essentially, black coal mining has been transferred from the tightly regulated and highly paid mines in Germany to blood-soaked, low-cost mines in Colombia. Okay, other sources of coal for Germany include cheap but incredibly environmentally destructive methods like mountaintop removal in the USA and unregulated mines in Siberia that coat nearby villages in coal dust, choking the inhabitants. And even if we put aside the fact that Germany greenwashed itself by outsourcing coal mining, it's not even true that they did it without sacking any workers. Most of the coal mining workforce was sacked or pushed into early retirement from the 1970s as German capitalism switched to cheaper imported coal. While there have been some provisions and retraining provided for workers in the closing mines, many of the former mining towns remain some of the poorest communities in the country. And it's not going to be renewables that fill the gap left in the market by phasing out coal. Moving forward, Germany intends to invest in natural gas, another fossil fuel, and biofuels, an environmentally destructive fuel source in its own right, to meet demand. So the point is that even at its best, we cannot rely on the state to deal with the climate crisis. South Korea and Germany are the best models of the Green New Deal strategy anywhere in the world. They have the technological capacity that potentially could have created a genuinely sort of Green New Deal, but they fall well short of the kind of drastic restructuring of society that would be needed to deal with the climate crisis. Okay. So the reason why we can't rely on the state is because it is not a neutral body that can be manipulated by whoever gets elected into parliament. As I mentioned earlier, capitalism is a class-divided system where a tiny minority control all the wealth in society and exploit the vast majority of people to continue to enrich themselves. This minority needs the state with all its institutions, the police, the judiciary, parliament, etc., to maintain their class rule. Modern states developed with the development of capitalism to manage the needs of capitalists within a particular geographical area and further their interest in the global market. They've always been, as Marx put it, a committee for managing the common affairs of the whole bourgeoisie. Capitalism is a system built around fossil fuel use. Fossil fuels underpin industry in most countries, including major economies like the US, Russia, China, and even Australia. Since the role of the capitalist state is to protect and advance the interests of capitalism, this means governing for the fossil fuel barons and the industries that depend on fossil fuels, rather than the mass of the population who suffer the consequences of their environmentally destructive practices. Another important factor that drives states to continue to invest and prop up the fossil fuel sector is global imperialism. The same competitive drive which forces all individual capitalists to keep making profit at all costs applies to competition between countries on a global scale. Capitalism is a globally interconnected system, and each country wants to have a competitive edge on the international market. This is why, despite climate summit after climate summit and state after state declaring climate emergencies or Green New Deals, next to nothing has happened to address climate change. No country is going to take the massive financial hit of entirely overhauling the economy because the massive cost and disruption it would cause would put them at a competitive disadvantage compared to other countries in the global system. And as imperialist tensions begin to heighten between major economies like the US and China, who are also major polluting economies, the chances of them diverting enormous amounts of money to completely reorganise their economies along sustainable lines is even more remote. So the examples I've given in this talk demonstrate that it's not possible to address the climate crisis and all its consequences for the working class, the poor, and the planet within the framework of capitalism. We need a new system based on internationalism that puts human need and the health of the planet first. Marxists look to the working class as a force for creating such a system. Collectively, they have the power to overthrow the parasitic capitalist class and reorder society to deal with the climate emergency on a democratic basis. A society like this would be able to carry out an internationally coordinated effort to address the environmental crises we face in a humane way, because it would not be held back by the destructive logic of profit and competition that underpins capitalism. We could utilise all the science and technology that exists today to reorganise society, industry along sustainable lines, open borders to climate refugees, and build homes designed to withstand the extreme temperatures we are set to face. We can coordinate international projects to deal with pollution and find ways to cope with the already irreversible effects of climate change that takes into account the needs of all humanity. The effects of climate change are already being felt on a massive scale. Extreme weather events like heat waves, droughts, cyclones, floods, and wildfires are becoming more frequent and intense. The ice sheets are melting at an accelerating rate, locking sea level rise in for centuries to come. But humanity has such potential to deal with the climate crisis. We have all the scientific and technical knowledge we need to build a genuinely just, democratic and sustainable society, liberated from the competitive scramble for short-term profit, where we can make decisions based on the long-term needs of human beings and the natural world that we depend on for our existence. The name for such a society is socialism. Our challenge today is to build a movement powerful enough to overthrow the existing destructive capitalist order and begin the task of building it.
Sorry, there are still quite a lot of hands up, but we've run out of time for this discussion. So I'm just going to hand over to Clara to make some final closing comments.
Cool. Well, besides the really cynical people who actually do just love capitalism and want to continue working with the system because of that, I think most people don't feel confident enough to actually that we can have a socialist system, which is why they still look to solutions under capitalism to solve the crisis. So looking at the actual massive scale of the crisis that I outlined, as well as the kind of relative weakness of our side, means that people just lack that hope. I think that's why they're kind of willing to pull the wool over their eyes and look to sort of really useless and ineffectual solutions like voting for Labor in the next election or whatever it may be. But when the working class and mass movements are kind of on the move, I think that can really offer people hope and the possibility that things could be different and that there's a power in society that can actually achieve that. And so I wanted to talk quickly, if you'll indulge me, about one of my favourite examples of working class power to actually challenge environmental destruction, and that's the anti-uranium mining movement here in Australia in the 80s. There's some of the largest deposits of uranium exist in Australia, yet we don't have a big nuclear power industry yet. As one of the speakers mentioned, that could actually become more of a thing in the future. And the reason is because there was mass social movements as well as, trade union intervention to stop that that industry from getting off the ground. And so workers, dock workers, rail workers, all sorts of unionised sections of the working class, who we're often told are some of the most, like, you know, climate denialists, don't give a shit about the planet type people. They refused to move yellow cake when it was on ships. They refused to load it onto trains and move it around the country, basically making it impossible for the industry to run. And that really meant that the anti-uranium mining movement could be so successful in that decade and stop uranium from nuclear from becoming such a big industry here. And we had a moratorium on uranium in New South Wales because of that. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about what it could be like if we did have socialism, because I guess some of you might have been to the Russian Revolution session yesterday or other sessions about that people might have mentioned Russia in, but they actually, after the revolution, had some of the most advanced policies of environmental sustainability in the world, like 100 years ago. So they had sustainable fisheries programs as well as like reforestation and sustainable forestry management, and also had one of the world's first seed banks to preserve seed varieties for the future. And that's because the working class was running society and they didn't have an interest in making profit out of the exploitation of these natural resources. They had an interest in maintaining them for future generations. And so I think even though conditions were pretty dire during the Civil War and the country was extremely poor, ordinary people made it a priority to look after the planet in that time, which kind of gives you a glimpse of what it could be like if we weren't one socialism on an international scale. So I think, what do we do today then? Well, I think it's our responsibility to intervene into the environment movement and make arguments with people that we can't lower our horizons to just like, you know, the Labor Party or whatever, that actually we need to argue, like Diane said, to abolish the fossil fuels and win as many people over to a strategy that capitalism is not able to resolve this crisis. And I think ultimately we do need to have a strong revolutionary socialist organisation to do that. We need more socialists who are intervening into those struggles. And when, like, the working class does start to move, when big social upheavals happen in the future, and they'll happen here too, like climate change is just going to exacerbate all of the crises that exist under capitalism today, like famine and inequality and, sort of problems with housing and all sorts of stuff. It's just there's going to be social struggles that erupt, and we want to be ready to win people to the argument that they can run the world and that they can win, they can smash capitalism and implement a system that's based on human need and the health of the planet.